I am Plante on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Andrea Bennett joins me now. They've just published a terrific book, Hearty, on cooking, eating, and growing food for pleasure and subsistence. Andrea's essays are not just on food. They're a marvelous entry point to other areas of investigation, whether it's the people who harvest and keep seeds or who grow sustainably in our communities, the food media we consume on television and now online, as well as Andrea's own life, their family, and their history. For example, Andrea looks at food that they've grown up with and wonders how it came to be, like their grandmother's chutney. It's fascinating to see Andrea figure out how it might have come to the palates of either their grandmother or even earlier. There's a lot of food for thought in the book, like how our habits are shaped by structural effects around us, how much food waste there is, as well as what we might be able to grow wherever we live. I'll ask Andrea about cooking, too. Andrea Bennett is a National Magazine Award-winning writer and a senior editor at the Taiyi. Their writing has been published in The Walrus, Chatelaine, The Atlantic, The Globe and Mail, among many other outlets. Their first book of essays, Like a Boy But Not a Boy, was one of CBC Books' 2020 picks for the top Canadian nonfiction of the year. Originally from Hamilton, Ontario, Andrea lives in Powell River, B.C., where they joined me from last week. This new book is published by ECW Press. Please welcome to the Plante Online program, Andrea Bennett. Andrea, good morning.
Good morning. Hello. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. This book is such a, as I was telling you just before we started, I enjoyed it a great deal because it reminds us about how food is such an easy way to talk about so many other things. I mean, you talk about certain foods and how they were in your life, and you even wonder about how they might have ended up in your life, and you talk about family lore and the sort. The book is often fun to read. There's also some you know, emotional moments, tough moments. How did you find the experience of writing it?
I'm so glad you found it fun to read. It was so important to me to try to make that happen, because I care a lot about the sort of values-related stuff around food, like making it more sustainable for people labor-wise and more sustainable environmentally. But the reality is that my favorite food writing to read tends to be stuff that feels really lively and a bit like hedonistic. So I wanted to sort of maintain that energy and ethos as I was writing and considering those other things. And the book was by turns fun and tricky to write. I think it was very, very fun for me to go into the field. So I did some reporting at different farms.
Yeah.
I tried to be on the ground and get some narrative in there because, again, that's what I like to read. And I've done a lot of different jobs over the years, but I have tended to work in journalism, magazine journalism, and now I work as a senior editor at the Taiyi. Just being able to blend some of the sort of reporting skills I've accumulated with that personal essay kind of ethos also felt like something I wanted to do in this book. The tricky part came about, I have a 6-year-old, she's now 6, turning 7, but it's very difficult to balance, you know, having a job, writing a book, having a kid, and so the funny and ironic thing about writing this book about food, local farming, etc., is that a whole bunch of it I wrote the only place that was open at like 6 a.m., which was when I could like dash out to try to meet the deadlines I'd set for myself for the essays.
Mm-hmm.
The only place that was open was the Starbucks. And so a lot of portions of first drafts were either written at 6 a.m. at the Starbucks or, you know, 8 or 9 or 10 p.m. After my kids gone to sleep at my desk. Yeah, I mean, I was motivated by the deadlines and enjoyed writing the bulk of the essays. Some of the first drafts were tricky to pull out of myself because it was, you know, 6 a.m. or 10 a.m. and I was tired. But overall, looking back on it, it's the positive experiences stand out the most, and in particular, chatting with people and being on site at farms and seeing how people are doing things. Yeah, it was all really fun.
Yeah, you talk about the seeds in one part of the book, and this is a marvelous example of the work that you did in terms of going out into the field and investigating. The people that are cultivating seeds for us and have done so for many years, and it really is the future, isn't it, in terms of, you know, if we want to grow something at home, a lot of these outfits that you visited are places that we ordered seeds from here in British Columbia.
Yeah.
The idea of saving seeds, mm-hmm. You know, some of these seeds, you buy some of these heirloom beans, for example. I can't remember the I think it's the Salt Spring outfit that you went to visit.
Yeah.
You know, those have gone back years and years and years, right?
They do. And I think it's the farm at Salt Spring that says, whatever we're growing now, we're standing on the shoulders of generations and generations of growers before us. And that's true of everything we eat. It's true of, if you take a look at any given vegetable, for example, carrots is what I focus on in the book because I love carrots. But they originated as an entirely different beast than they are now, like a little bit more like Queen Anne's lace, like a bitter kind of root.
Mm-hmm.
And it was through just like generations of cultivation that a carrot became a carrot as we know it. And so a lot of that work is still being done. There is a distinction to be made between open pollinated seeds and hybrid seeds. Hybrid seeds are, it's essentially like when we cross a couple varieties of plant in a controlled situation, and then a seed is produced from that. And hybrid seeds can be super helpful, and I use them in my garden. If you have a shorter growing season or a wetter growing season than a plant generally enjoys, then hybrid seeds are a really great way of creating a productive plant that responds to those situations adequately. Open pollinated seeds, though, let us save our own seeds, and it takes a longer time to tailor a seed to its environment that way with open pollinated seeds. It's still possible, but it's really important work, and it's something that home growers have played a big role in because you can choose to have a couple sort of like pet seeds that you're keeping alive. And sometimes, in some cases, it has been kind of one person who's kept a seed alive. So there are now a lot of different, there are seed libraries that people keep going in different places. There's one on Salt Spring. And it just means that there's more variety, there's more to fall back on. We're not as reliant on any given seed company to keep those seeds going. And a lot of the smaller seed companies, including like West Coast Seeds, Salt Spring Seeds in BC, they still retain an ethos around open pollination and prioritizing organic seeds where they can. And it just stands in stark contrast to some of the bigger multinational corporations that have aimed to make seeds kind of more akin to intellectual property. Rather than sort of like a community responsibility and a right. It's very tricky for a local grower. You know, there's been a lot of emphasis on local food for the past, 20 years in a particular kind of way, like the farmer's market or community share agricultural box direction, which has created it's made a lot of positive change, but it's often not possible for those farms. It's an extra step to do the growing out of seeds. So one of the farms I visited, or some of them on Salt Spring, do focus on that. They've built it into their annual cycle, and it just provides a really cool model for local growers to try to follow or perhaps consider building in. It's tricky. Yeah. I'm fascinated by seeds.
Yeah, it is a fascinating part of the book. The one knock, though, on having a garden is that it's a lot of work. So we're talking in mid-November. Are you still growing things this time of year?
Interestingly, I had such a busy year this past year that I scaled my own garden way back. And normally I grow like a big chorus of vegetables. And this year I just wasn't sure if I was going to be able to do it in the same way. And so I focused on things I could direct sow. I grew poppies and to save for poppy seeds and a variety of different beans and peas.
Uh-huh.
And that was my focus this year. Everything from sort of fava beans and scarlet runners to soup peas. And anyway, it is a lot of work. I think that it's a hobby. It's something I find joy from, and it's something I learn a lot through doing. And I really personally appreciate being able to make pasta sauce and salsa and just save things for the winter and things like that. But I think that what it taught me was the future of food resiliency can't actually rely on backyard gardening. It has to rely on community efforts that are focused on both local growing through farms and other types of growing and harvesting, but also, you know, maybe through community food processing steps, because it's a lot of work to take all of that food and to create things from it that are going to show up in your pantry, show up in your freezer. And so I think that the next step, personally, I think the next step after the sort of farmers market movement is to think about different like community and structural ways that we can practice local food that makes it more accessible to more people, that values people for their skill sets, and that views it more as, you know, something that community members can do all together, as opposed to having it be on like a household to household basis. Because you're right, it's an absolute ton of work, and I don't think it's reasonable to expect everyone to do that. And
yeah.
A lot of people live in apartments these days. I didn't have a garden until I lived in a place that had soil. So
yeah. You know, in our neighborhood here in East Van. You know, people were sharing things that they grew out of their garden, and you know, it's easy, you know, at the end of August to you know, just be inundated with tomatoes that you get sick of tomatoes or you know, whatever vegetable, you know, one person has planted, right? It's a wonderful thing to share and stuff, but I mean, by September, you know, you're back at the grocery store buying your vegetables, right?
That's right, yeah.
So I mean, it works, I guess, in theory, but in practice, it's not altogether reliable. And that's one of the other things you talk in the book are you know, there are a lot of problems in terms of how we get our food, and structural problems that affect how we eat, not just you know now, but structural problems in the past that shape our diets today. And I think that's something that we don't think about or don't even talk about. And it's easy for a lot of people to think, you know, that one's diet, you know, is a moral failure or a lack of willpower or just bad habits. Those are things we need to address, right? How better do you think we should as a culture talk about these things?
Yeah, good question. I think that the most important thing to do when approaching these conversations is to do it non-judgmentally. I think that it's important to acknowledge the difficulties we're facing. And when I started thinking about conventional agriculture or industrial agriculture, in BC, for example, in the winter, as you alluded to, you know, we don't have fresh tomatoes in the winter. That's not reasonable. Someone might grow them in a greenhouse, but it's not reasonable. And so ours come from California or Mexico or Arizona. We rely really heavily on California, like a lot of places do, for a lot of our caloric intake in the winter, produce in the winter. And California is facing massive drought, and you know, it's sort of a lot of this produce is grown in these arid areas that then need to be irrigated by redirecting river flow. And we're just reaching the end of the lifetime where that kind of borrowing is possible. Industrial agriculture came about with chemical fertilizers and stuff like that. And when it came about, it was able to halt a lot of food insecurity and create this great abundance. And I think that it's important to recognize that. And it's also important to say, okay, we've seen the issues that have cropped up with this, and it's now time to think about what our new solutions are going to be and how we're going to address it, because a lot of different issues have cropped up, and yeah, we're hitting a wall with our resources. We have really borrowed from our future in a bit, in a way. And the other way we're subsidizing our food costs is by through the fact that the laborers who are working to grow and harvest that produce aren't being paid fair wages. Mm. So, yeah, that's something I believe in wholeheartedly. Like, food cannot be sustainable if it's not sustainable for the workers that are growing it, that are making it for us. So, I think it's important to talk about those issues, but not put them at the feet of anybody. Like, all of us tend to be doing the best that we can with what we have. So if we want real change to come about, it's through working together. And sometimes it's through things that people like to, conservatives like to say red tape.
Sure,
it's through bureaucratic changes or regulations, or it's also through visioning together how we can do things better. Sometimes it's via, like, you know, with local food, we tend to focus on produce a lot, but obviously produce is not what we're eating from day to day. All, you know, that's one part of our diet, but also another part of our diet is like grains. Another part is proteins, whether that's meat or pulses. Another part is dairy. So if we want to get serious about local food, we have to get serious about all those different planks of local food. And that does include processing. So, you know, we need to be making our own cheeses. A lot of the stuff we've done to centralize abattoirs or slaughterhouses or cheese making or dairy, dairy processing. If we want more, if we want stronger local food systems, all of that stuff, I think, has to come back to communities a little bit more. And that's all possible. I think it's possible to return to basics. But, I mean, I find a lot of joy in returning to basics. It's fun. And I am one of those sort of food nerds who will love to make salsa and cake. And, in another life, I could be a cheesemaker. I think that would be fun.
I found the book incredibly aspirational in terms of, you're talking about things you're making. Like, the book begins with you... I forget what it is now that you picked from the neighbor's garden and turned into lemonade. Lilacs, that's it. I found that, encouraging for me to think, maybe I could try something like that one day. You never know, maybe I will. Have you found a way to make good onion rings at home, though?
Yeah, I make onion rings. I have an enameled cast iron pot that I use, and so I'll clip like a little thermometer to it and just use some kind of neutral oil. And then we usually I have to go buy like gluten-free beer, and then I'll make a beer batter gluten-free flour, and then some onion rings. I also really love making onion bhajis that way. Usually we'll have a few times a year, we'll have sort of like a fry week, and we'll use that same oil.
Right.
Usually we start with donuts, and then we'll do something savory, but a little bit more neutral. And it's usually at the last thing we make with our fry week is onion rings or onion bhajis.
See, that's a great way to think about it, because a lot of us, like fried food, essentially. Mm-hmm. Making it can be prohibitive in terms of, say, you have this batch of oil that most of us use once, and we need to learn to use it, say, more than once. And that it involves a lot of planning, and it can, a week of stuff can be done from one batch. I mean, that's a great way to think about just being sustainable in your own kitchen, say.
Yeah, I have friends who are, like, less interested in food, and another thing that we'll do, because I like this stuff, is we'll kind of do a bit of a labor trade.
Mm.
I have a friend who likes to come over and bake, and maybe I'll help her out, and maybe she'll do the dishes, and that's great, because I don't love doing the dishes. So I think that, yeah, there are ways to do it kind of together, and, I don't know,
yeah.
Special occasion type stuff, or just, yeah, if it's, I feel like if it's not someone's passion, then that's totally okay. I just wish that we had ways of working together. Yeah. Do labor trade-offs, because I think there is like a significant percentage of the population that kind of has this type of skill set and inclination.
Yeah.
So we should, I think we should value that a little bit more and learn how to work it in for the greater good, I guess. Absolutely.
See, I like working in the kitchen, but again, I hate doing the dishes, and it annoys me when I watch something like The Bear, and I see them, you know, having to clean up at the end of the night.
Oh yeah.
You know, I would hate to work in a restaurant just because of that. So.
Yeah, when I think about working in restaurants, like I've worked in restaurants for about a decade, and when I think back, the memories that stand out most are just being sort of hot. And, it's such a hot and humid environment.
Yeah.
I loved opening, but yeah, closing, you'd have to be cleaning everything at the end of the night. Not as much fun. Very important,
You know, I found it melancholy when you talk about family relations lost or distancing.
Okay.
I found it just, you're so generous in sharing that with the reader. A lot of memories, good and bad as well. And you attach those to certain foods, like potatoes, for example. You know, I found that just a marvelous way of thinking about that food product and what that has meant in your life, say, or how that's come up in your life. In terms of writing what you have, how did you find that part of the book in terms of writing about certain family members and what relations are like, you know, and have been over the years?
Yeah. So one of the essays is about making my Nana's chutney, and I made it at a time when we were estranged, and she's now passed, and we did get to talk before she passed, but that it was, I missed her chutney. She used to make it for me when I was a kid. And I missed her a lot when we were in a period of estrangement. And making her chutney was a way for me to reclaim that relationship for myself a bit. And also it reminded me of why and how I was a strong enough person to sort of stand up for myself in a situation that I needed to stand up for myself in. And just sort of appreciate the complexity of my relationship with her. And for me, it really did sort of crystallize in these jars of chutney, or the process of making them and then eating them. I was able to share with my kid some of my Nana, and I think that'll continue to be true as she gets older. And I do appreciate that, like carrying on some family traditions by making different foods. I also made my Grandma Garcia's trifle, which was really fun. And I learned that it was like a century-old recipe, which was wild to me. I learned a surprising amount. In particular, my dad's side of the family is very story-oriented. They tell a lot of stories about themselves, their history, and they've kept a lot of their sort of like food culture stuff alive. It was my grandmother, I guess my dad immigrated here when he was a kid. It was his parents who chose to immigrate from England.
Uh-huh.
There's still a lot of stuff I didn't quite realize was I have a more English palate or British palate than then my partner and my kid, for example. I'm the only one who eats pickled beets. Beans on toast. So it was fun to look into that, actually, and also to learn, like, I've been more or less vegetarian my whole life. At this point, like, vegetarian-ish. I do eat a bit of meat. I don't, like, keep it out of my diet, but I'm way more likely to eat sort of, like, bread and cheese. And I learned that some of my habits were, like, probably generations old and just kind of emanate from my class background. My ancestors in England worked as laborers and farmers, and they would have had, like, a hunk of bread and a hunk of cheese and, like, either an onion or later on some chutney to eat along with it, something sharp. And that's still the way I like to eat. So it was fun to figure that out. And,
yeah. That one chapter where you talk about your nana's chutney, and you go into the history of mm-hmm. how chutney came to England or how it evolved in England the way it has. I just found that fascinating, and that part of the research, say, I mean, that must be fun if you're a foodie or someone interested in food.
Super fun, and I think. Food moves around the world a lot, and so it's bound up in these complex colonial relationships. And there's been this evolving conversation about, like, authenticity mm-hmm. and cultural appropriation in food. And so I was certainly thinking about that kind of stuff, but trying to approach things just with an open mind and figure out what their roots are. And definitely, like, chutney is bound up in the colonial relationship between England and India, and there's a lot of complex stuff there. But I spoke with Simon Majumdar for the book. I spoke with a lot of cool people for the book, but he was saying for him, like, his thinking about this kind of stuff in terms of authenticity has ebbed and flowed over the years, and yeah, you know, English chutney is an authentic type of food that has a particular history and particular roots, and I just find it fascinating to study in kind of non-judgmental way, mm-hmm. like how it sort of evolved amongst the palates of English people and how that differs from where it came from in India. And it was my goal to figure out, like, what chutney, my nana's chutney, kind of came from, where its specific roots were. And I wasn't really able to figure that out. But I got some senses.
Yeah, you ask your dad, which I found interesting. Yeah. He's quite close to your mother's family as a young man. And he was able to give you some insight that you probably would not have, say, thought about if you hadn't been thinking about these things, writing about them as you have.
Yeah, that's right. I was thinking about all the different components, like everything from vinegar to sugar to tomatoes to peppers.
Mm-hmm.
Every single ingredient, beyond the fact that it's a chutney and it's sort of like conception started in India, every single ingredient is bound up in like some sort of colonial relationship or trade relationship that goes back centuries, decades. So, and yeah, I did learn from my dad. It was interesting. He and my mom got together when they were teens, so he spent a lot of time in that household in my mother's childhood home
mm-hmm.
When he was younger. And he was the person that I could plumb for that information. He's a keeper of family stories. Not a great cook, but a keeper of the family stories. And both of those things are important. So, yeah.
Yeah, it got me thinking about, you know, like growing up, you know, you saw certain brands, say, in the pantry or in the kitchen. And it got me thinking as to why that was. It reminded me of, like, Coke and Pepsi, for example. We had a lot of Pepsi growing up, and I like Coke in particular.
Yeah.
And then I found out as I was growing up that my dad had worked at a Pepsi factory or a Pepsi bottling concern in the Philippines as a kid. And that's the reason why it's Pepsi and 7-Up at our house growing up rather than, say, Coke and Sprite.
Yeah.
And I would not have known that if I hadn't asked a question about why that was.
Yeah. I love learning that kind of stuff. And it's interesting, like, what is familiar to you as a person from your kind of family situation ends up feeling like the authentic thing.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of the case, so... Yeah, my best friend's mom drank Diet Pepsis throughout our childhood. I don't know. So much of my memory is tied to those kinds of details. I think it's cool. It teaches us a lot about ourselves.
Absolutely.
Especially if we ask nosy questions.
Well, here's a nosy question to wrap up, Andrea. We're talking, it's about 12:30 now, so it's lunchtime. Have you had lunch yet?
I haven't.
And so...
What am I going to have for
lunch? Yeah, that's usually what I ask food people when I interview them on the show.
Yeah. I think that my partner is currently making some grilled cheeses that we're going to have with some leftover tomato and lentil soup today. And there's some... The soup is supposed to have a potato in it, but when I went to make it, we had no potatoes, and so it has some buckwheat in it, just for kicks.
You know, I have to have lunch in a few minutes, and I guess I was just looking for an idea.
Oh, yeah. A meal that I have been eating a lot, I get tired of breakfast for some reason. I get tired of breakfast foods. And so something I've been eating a lot is rice with just like heated frozen corn and edamame. And then I take a can of tuna and I mix it with mayo and gochujang.
Uh-huh.
And I have been finding that particular meal like so satisfying. Again, it hasn't like captured the attention of my household in the same way. But if I was being left to my own devices for lunch, and there wasn't something on the stove already, that's probably what I would make myself.
Yeah. See, growing up Filipinos, I did with parents who are Filipino, rice was, something that, was not unusual for breakfast even. And so...
Yeah. I've been eating it for breakfast. I like to make it for lunch, like two portions, and then save half for the next morning.
Yeah, that's one of the great things. So you make a pot of rice, you can use it for 2-3 meals, right?
Yeah, I love Ray.
Indeed, yeah. I have had such fun talking to you. This is such a beautiful book. I was quite moved by it in a number of parts. And as I said, I was also inspired to do certain things in the kitchen that I probably wouldn't have if I hadn't read the book. Congratulations on it, and I so appreciate your time today. Thanks for this.
Thank you so much. That's so cool to hear.
The book is called Hearty on Cooking, Eating, and Growing Food for Pleasure and Subsistence. It's from ECW Press. It's author Andrea Bennett. Join me on the line from Powell River in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunto.